Listener supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
Is Democracy Now!
Every impeachment trial of any official in the history of the United States has featured witnesses. So the Democratic request for four fact witnesses and three specific sets of relevant documents is very much in line with our history.
With House Speaker Nancy Pelosi preparing to send impeachment articles to the Senate, Democrats are pressing the Republican leadership to allow witness testimony. A number of Republicans, including Mitt Romney, back holding a vote on witnesses. We'll get the latest. Then to Moms for Housing. We go to Oakland, where a group of mothers fighting homelessness are waging a battle against real estate speculators by occupying a vacant house with their children and facing eviction.
We're taking a stand, and it doesn't end with one house. We want to take Oakland back from all speculators.
Yeah.
Plus, the poet Martina Spada will share one of his latest poems, a tribute to the late New York community activist Luis Garden-Acosta, who is a member of the Young Lords. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump is now trying to claim that it, quote, doesn't really matter, unquote, whether Iranian General Qasem Soleimani posed an imminent threat before the United States assassinated him in a drone strike at the Baghdad International Airport January 3rd. Trump's words from a tweet yesterday come after Trump spent days claiming Soleimani was planning to attack four U.S. embassies. But Trump's claims began to unravel after his own defense secretary, Mark Esper, said he had not seen specific evidence of any planned embassy attacks. This is President Trump answering questions from reporters about his changing claims.
Well, first of all, I think it's been totally consistent. But here's what's been consistent. We killed Soleimani, the number one terrorist in the world by every account. Bad person, killed a lot of Americans, killed a lot of people.
That was Trump speaking on Monday. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is dismissing the Iraqi parliament's vote demanding the United States withdraw its troops from Iraq, which came after the U.S. assassination of Soleimani in Baghdad. The Wall Street Journal is reporting the State Department warned Iraq that the United States could shut down Iraq's access to its own bank account held at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York if Iraq forces U.S. troops to withdraw from Iraq. And Iran says it has arrested several people as part of the investigation into how Iran mistakenly shot down a Ukrainian airliner taking off from Tehran en route to Kiev, killing all 176 people on board. The plane crash came after Iran fired missiles at Iraqi military bases housing Iraqi and U.S. troops as retaliation for Soleimani's assassination. The missiles killed no one. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker has announced he's dropping out of the presidential race, leaving only one black candidate, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, in the race. Six candidates will take the stage tonight for the seventh Democratic presidential debate in Des Moines, Iowa. All white candidates, the last debate before the Iowa caucuses. Tensions between Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders have been rising in recent days. Senator Warren issued a statement yesterday saying Senator Sanders came to her house for a private dinner with just the two of them in November of 2018 and said, quote, this is Warren's statement, among the topics that came up was what would happen if Democrats nominated a female candidate. I thought a woman could win. He disagreed, Warren said. Senator Sanders called the claims ludicrous. This is Sanders' senior advisor, Jeff Weaver, speaking to CNN's Chris Cuomo.
For anybody to say that a woman can't win, it doesn't make sense. Hillary Clinton won 3 million more votes than Donald Trump did in the last election. So there's some wires crossed here, but clearly Bernie Sanders did not say that a woman could not win.
Meanwhile, New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says she's launching a new political action committee meant to challenge the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Ocasio-Cortez's PAC would help fund progressive challengers to take on both Republican incumbents and centrist Democrats. The congressmember recently said she wouldn't be paying her dues to the DCCC in the 2019-2020 election cycle, and that she'd prefer to donate to individual Democratic candidates. In immigration news, the Trump administration's planning to divert an additional $7.2 billion from the military budget for the construction of Trump's promised border wall, bringing the total amount allocated to wall construction so far to over $18 billion. Meanwhile, in Chicago, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, is detaining fewer immigrants. ICE says that's because of new Illinois laws such as the Trust Act, which bar police from detaining people based on their immigration status. Chicago's sanctuary ordinance also prohibits police from giving ICE agents access to people who are in the custody of local police. This comes as, in Arizona, a trial is underway over the conditions in Border Patrol's short-term detention facilities. Immigrant rights groups have condemned the horrific conditions, quote-unquote, inside these facilities, including overcrowding, freezing temperatures, and lack of adequate food, water, or medical care. And in more news on global migration, a 10-year-old child was found dead at a Paris airport in the undercarriage of a plane that arrived from the Ivory Coast. Meanwhile, eight children were among the 11 migrants who drowned when their boat sank off the western coast of Turkey as they attempted to reach Europe. Turkey and Russia have brokered a ceasefire for the Syrian province of Idlib, where the Russian-backed Syrian regime has been fighting a brutal offensive aimed at capturing the territory from rebel groups. There are some reports of the Syrian regime violating the ceasefire, which took effect midnight Sunday. France says it'll send about 200 additional troops to West Africa. Even as many protesters in Mali and other West African nations are calling on France to withdraw the more than 4,000 troops it's stationed in the former French colonies. West African leaders are warning of increasing violence in the Sahel region. This is Burkina Faso President Rochemar Christian Kabour.
2019 was a difficult year for the Sahel in general and for the Lake Chad region, insofar that I would say that the increase of attacks in the Sahel, the human and material destruction that we are suffering, and the unprecedented humanitarian crisis we are experiencing in this zone.
In Pakistan, at least 55 people have died after avalanches swept through Pakistan-controlled Kashmir in recent days. About a dozen more residents are missing. 2019 was the hottest year for the world's oceans on record. That's according to a new study published in the journal Advances in Atmospheric Sciences. The Earth's surface temperature also recorded its second hottest year on record last year, as the climate crisis leads to the warming of the Earth's oceans and atmosphere. Attorney General William Barr is demanding Apple unlock the phones of the alleged gunman of a deadly shooting at the Naval Air Station in Pensacola, Florida, escalating tensions between the Justice Department and Apple in a legal battle over personal privacy. Last month, Saudi Air Force officer Mohammed Al-Shamrani killed three sailors and wounded eight others on the base. Barr yesterday declared the shooting an act of terrorism. 21 Saudi military cadets who were training in the U.S. are now being expelled from the country and sent back to Saudi Arabia after an investigation launched after the Pensacola shooting. And this year's Oscar nominations have just been announced. Among the top nominated movies was Joker, for which Joaquin Phoenix received a nomination for Best Actor. Edge of Democracy, about Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff and Lula da Silva, was nominated for the Best Documentary. And Harriet star Cynthia Erivo was nominated for Best Actress, making her the only Black actor nominated for an Oscar this year. And not a single woman was nominated for Best Director for a second year in a row. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show looking at the upcoming impeachment trial of President Trump. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is expected to send the two articles of impeachment to the Senate as early as Wednesday. The House impeached Trump in December for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress related to Trump's efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate his political rival Joe Biden. Three Republican senators, Mitt Romney of Utah, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Susan Collins of Maine, have said they want the Senate to call former National Security Advisor John Bolton as a witness during the Senate impeachment trial. Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee has said he may also vote to hear witnesses. He told Politico, quote, "It's important to have a vote on whether we have witnesses or not."
The timing of the Senate impeachment trial could also impact the 2020 presidential race. Three Democratic candidates, Senators Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Amy Klobuchar, will have to leave the campaign trail for the trial, which could begin this week. On Monday, Senator Cory Booker dropped out of the race in part because of the time demands of the impeachment trial. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting a security firm has uncovered evidence that Russian military hackers have attempted to attack the Ukrainian gas company where Hunter Biden once served on the board of directors. To talk more about the upcoming impeachment trial, we're joined by Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate.com, where she's senior legal correspondent and Supreme Court reporter. So what are we going to see today, Dahlia?
I think we're going to see everybody pedaling as fast as they can to own the narrative here. I think that Nancy Pelosi is feeling at least a little bit better about the fact that they're going to be witnesses. It looks as though there are enough Republican senators saying we at least want to vote on whether they're going to be witnesses, which is, I think, what her end game was, to have some kind of fair process. At the same time, we see Mitch McConnell doing the touchdown dance yesterday, saying everything she did was pointless. I won everything and I'm going to have it my way. So I think as today plays out, we're going to see a decision on whether to convey the articles today, tomorrow. We're hearing there's going to be opening statements as soon as next Tuesday. So this thing is going to start and hit the ground running. And I think very quickly, we're going to have to see whether there's a process that allows for witness testimony.
And what about the issue of John Bolton's potential testimony? How important is that? And do you feel, is your sense is that the votes are there to call for him to come and testify?
Well, we're certainly hearing that Romney's interested. I think that Murkowski and Collins, as you all said, are very, very interested in at least knowing that they have made the gesture at we want to know what he has to say. And I think they're really being pincered by an electorate that wants to hear from witnesses. But what Bolton has to say is unbelievably consequential.
But yet the president has indicated that he might invoke executive privilege. He told Fox News that he might do that to prevent Bolton from testifying in the impeachment trial. Fox News host Laura Ingraham interviewed him on Friday.
Why not call Bolton? Why not allow him to testify? This thing is bogus. Why
I would have no Bolton problem testify? Other than one thing. You can't be in the White House as president. Future. I'm talking about future, many future presidents, and have a security advisor. Anybody having to do with security and legal and other things.
You're going to invoke executive privilege?
Well, I think you have to for the sake of the office.
And speaking to reporters last Tuesday, Trump said Bolton wouldn't know anything about the impeachment charges.
Well,
would know nothing about what we're talking about, because if you know, the Ukrainian government came out with a very strong statement, no pressure, no anything, and that's from the boss, that's from the president of Ukraine.
What's your sense about that?
Well, at least with respect to the latter question, we know Bolton knows a lot because we've already heard testimony in the House that he said, I want nothing to do with this drug deal that's being cooked up with Giuliani. So we know Bolton has actually taken a strong position against what was happening in Ukraine. As to the question of privilege, executive privilege does not mean that Bolton cannot testify. It means he can sit there and testify as to those things that are not privileged and invoke the privilege where it applies. It doesn't mean there's an all-out bar on his showing up.
Do you think that the assassination of Soleimani could be Trump throwing out a bone to Bolton because he's so concerned about what he might testify? And as soon as he did the assassination, Bolton tweeted, you know, we've been working on this for a long time.
I think there is some signaling going on between Bolton and the president that none of us fully understands. I think the fact that Bolton has said, I have material evidence and I would like to present it, suggests he didn't get everything he wants from this Soleimani assassination. But I think the larger point for Bolton is he's trying at every turn to do right after he has the opportunity to do the big thing. He says he's going to do it when it's too late. This looks like it's of a piece with that. He's been saying pretty consistently, I have things to say, I wish I could say them.
And Chief Justice John Roberts will be presiding over the trial. What's your sense of what his role will be?
That's the most interesting question to me as a John Roberts watcher, is that there's two models. There's the Salmon Chase model from the Andrew Johnson impeachment, and then there's the William Rehnquist model from the Clinton impeachment. Chase was unbelievably involved, let himself be the tiebreaker, was absolutely aggressively involved in rulings in the Johnson impeachment. Rehnquist famously, after the Clinton impeachment, said, I did nothing and I did it very well. I think John Roberts is much more apt to be what we saw in the Rehnquist model, to do nothing and do it very elegantly.
I want to go to 2016. This is Trump calling Chief Justice Roberts a disaster.
Justice Roberts turned out to be an absolute disaster. He turned out to be an absolute disaster because he gave us Obamacare.
So, your response, Dahlia Lithwick.
So interesting that Trump never went after Anthony Kennedy, who also gave so many things that Trump purports to hate, but he didn't go after Kennedy. He went after Roberts. And Roberts and he have been involved in a very, very low-level slap fight about whether Trump can go after judges. John Roberts famously said last year, there's no such thing as Trump judges and Obama judges. All judges are the same. Those are fighting words from John Roberts. Do I think it means that John Roberts is in the tank for impeachment? No, I don't. I think John Roberts is in the tank for the judiciary and the integrity and the dignity of the judiciary.
And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, he has said he can't be an impartial juror. He just went to the White House to meet with President Trump about the impeachment trial. Could he somehow declare that the bar was not met for high crimes and misdemeanors? How does this work?
Well, I think that Donald Trump yesterday started signaling, we should just acquit me before anything happens. We shouldn't even have a trial. It's clear McConnell does not have the votes to do that. And so I think that cannot happen. It's important to realize everything that has to happen procedurally requires 51 votes. That seems like an easy jump when you have 53. But it's pretty clear that these processes are going to be set on the backs of people like Collins and Murkowski and other senators who are really, really worried about their reelection bid. So I don't think it's as simple as McConnell doing things by fiat and the entire party falling in line on every issue.
And finally, the Democrats are meeting today, caucusing, and Nancy Pelosi is expected to name the prosecutors. What's the importance of the prosecutors from the House in this trial?
The formal word is managers. They become the impeachment managers, and they essentially become, as you say, the prosecuting attorneys. There's some conversation about whether Justin Amash might be one of them. He's the independent who broke off from the Republican Party. And again, that's some interesting signaling if she does that. But they will probably come from the Intelligence Committee and the committees that oversaw the House processes. And they will essentially present their best case. Donald Trump's attorneys, for his part, will be Jay Sekulow and Pat Cipollone, and they are going to...
And Giuliani, who
desperately wants to be at that table. I think that's not going to happen, but that's going to be the prosecutors and the defense.
Well, we hope you will keep us posted. Of course, we will turn back to you. Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor at Slate.com, where she is the senior legal correspondent and Supreme Court reporter. She also hosts the podcast that you call...
Amicus.
When we come back, Moms for Housing. A group of mothers in Oakland are fighting homelessness by occupying a vacant house. They are threatened with eviction. Hundreds of people turned out last night to protect them. Stay with us.
As we travel far and near, we bring the word for you to hear, and the message that we bring is alive in the words we say.
Can't Take Away Our Music by Eric Burdon and War featuring Sharon Scott. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to Oakland, California, where a group of mothers fighting homelessness are waging a battle against real estate speculators demanding permanent solutions to the Bay Area's housing crisis by occupying a vacant house with their children. The struggle began in November when working mothers in West Oakland moved into 2928 Magnolia Street, a vacant house owned by real estate investment firm Wedgewood Properties. The firm tried to evict them, claiming they were illegally squatting on private property, but the mothers went to court and filed a right to possession claim, saying housing is a human right. Their name is Moms for Housing.
This is a video by Brandon Jordan and Marion Mickelberg.
My name is Dominique Walker. I am one of the co-founders of Moms for Housing, and the goal of our organization is to reclaim houses back into the hands of the community and to house unsheltered moms and children. There's four vacant houses for every one homeless person in Oakland.
We are reclaiming this house from a billion-dollar corporation who bought this house at a foreclosed price. It has been vacant for 2 years while people are living out on the street.
We felt like this was necessary to take this step. Like, even when I personally tried to go through the proper channels to get help to move and be able to pay these rent, they're still not affordable. So I feel like it was up to us to organize ourselves to be able to have housing.
In the last 2 years, homelessness in Oakland has increased by 47%. With average rental rates in Oakland rising to nearly $3,000 a month, there are few or no options for most people looking for housing.
There are 6,000 to 8,000 folks sleeping on the streets, and that's not even accounting for all of the unhoused people and housing insecure. Homelessness affects your mental health, brain development in children, their physical health, and 28% of the homeless population now in Oakland is under the age of 18. I have a one-year-old and a four-year-old. She'll be five on Saturday, and they have been so happy to have a place to call home. It's our fridge, stove, kitchen area. We had to do a lot of fixing up this house, and we're still working on it. This house was not kept up to code. My children have been so excited to be sheltered. My one-year-old start walking since we've been in the house, and he's had a baby zone where he can crawl around and stand up and start to take those first steps. And he did that here. This house was owned by Wedgewood, a company that is a displacement machine. They're composed of five different companies. They all play a role in the direct displacement of people.
We're taking a stand, and it doesn't end with one house. We want to take Oakland back to all speculators.
Yeah.
Wedgewood Properties has offered to pay for moving expenses and temporary housing for the women for 2 months if they vacate the house. A proposal Moms for Housing has rejected. The battle for the house came to a head last week when an Alameda County judge ruled in favor of Wedgewood Properties and ordered the mothers to vacate the house. But Moms for Housing has stayed to fight eviction. Monday night, hundreds of people from the neighborhood and beyond gathered at the house after receiving a tip that the sheriff's office was coming to evict the families.
Stop the eviction! We won't move! Stop the eviction! We won't move!
My name's Nicole. I'm an organizer with Mom's House Solidarity Committee, and we just got word that the sheriffs were on their way to evict Moms for Housing. And so we sent out a text blast to over 1,800 people, and that was maybe 15 minutes ago. As you can see, we've got hundreds of people showing up to defend the house, which is a really beautiful and awesome thing. And so we're here, and we're holding fast.
Thank you for your support!
People are out here. The community has had enough. We've had enough. And this shows you that we've had enough, and we're going to fight back.
The rent is too damn high. The rent is too damn high. The rent, the rent, the rent is too damn high. The rent, the rent,
plans to run up in here tonight. That didn't happen. They were on the 5 o'clock news saying that they would be indoors any minute. And then they had another person here saying that they would come in at 7, and they didn't. So I think they understand how, like Dominique said, how the town get down. So we got report that it was on CNN that the sheriff said there would be no entry tonight. Reason for applause, and at the same time, we don't trust the sheriff. Please go home if you have a home to go to and get some rest, because this is still the beginning of a fight.
That was Carol Fife, who's joining us live in the studio. The piece produced by Brandon Jordan and Marion Meckelberg. As we go now to Berkeley, California, where we're joined by Moms for Housing's Dominique Walker and Carol Fife, the director of the Oakland Office for Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! I don't know if you've gotten any sleep, but Carol, that's you speaking last night. There are hundreds of people who are in front of the house. You say you heard on CNN that the sheriff said, okay, he's not moving in. But explain what's happening now.
Right. We got word from the daughter of Dorothy King of Everett and Jones that she saw it on the news that there would be no entry by the sheriffs last night. They did drive by a couple more times, but they did not attempt to enter the home to serve the eviction notice. So we're going into our second day of eviction defense for Moms for Housing.
And Carol, could you talk a little bit about the scope and the scale of the housing crisis that that Oakland is facing, but that many cities across the country have similar problems, if not at the level of the situation right now in Oakland?
Right. After the housing crisis and the foreclosure crisis of 2008, many homeowners lost their primary residences, their only residences. And so that allowed speculators and the banks that were bailed out by the government at that time to come in and scoop up homes at rock bottom prices. So that is still happening, and we're still experiencing the impacts of the foreclosure crisis, with speculators owning 35% of the housing stock in America. So some state that Oakland has the worst speculation crisis in the country. And that's observable by how high the rents are. You have the median one bedroom market rate unit starting at around $2,500 a month. And so the housing wage, which is different from the minimum wage or a living wage in Alameda County, where Oakland is located, is $40.88 per hour. And that is out of reach for many of Oakland's working class people.
Dominique Walker, you're one of the women who, with your families, are occupying this house. Explain when you got into it and what is happening right now, how long you've been there, and what this legal process has been, what your plans are.
Yes, we moved in to Magnolia Street on November 18th. We've been there ever since, and we count that as a win. We've provided shelter for our children. This came out of absolute desperation, out of going through every program set up to help families in this predicament. Nothing helped. We were turned away. Programs were, the funding was cut from programs that were set up to help. This was an act of desperation, and it just gives light to the bigger issue going on here all over the world.
And could you talk a little bit about what your situation before you decided to occupy this particular property, your housing situation with your family?
Yes, I moved back to Oakland in April 2019 with my two small children from Mississippi. And I was working full time with a part time job as well, and could not afford rents. First, I was staying housing insecure, living with family members, but most of my entire community has been displaced. I was born and raised in Oakland, and most of folks are either displaced out at least 45 minutes to a couple hours out, or they're displaced onto the street. So I was commuting for hours trying to get into Oakland to serve my community. And after situations didn't work out, living on couches and in rooms, I was living in hotel rooms. And being homeless is very violent. And I've seen the development in my children since they've had shelter. My son took his first steps on Magnolia Street, said his first words. My daughter turned 5 in the house on Magnolia Street. It's an absolute necessity to have shelter, and it's a basic human right.
So the San Francisco Chronicle says almost 70% of the people living in Oakland streets are African American. However, African Americans constitute just 28% of Oakland's population. I wanted to talk about one of the young people who are in the house. Let's turn to Destiny Johnson. She's one of the kids living in, well, what everyone is calling now Mom's House.
Okay, so what's the what? What's going on? What's happening? My mom and lots of other moms, all who have young kids, all who are experiencing some kind of homelessness, took over this abandoned home, a vacant property, a house no one was living in for close to 2 years. We fixed it up, now we live in it. We made it a home. And here it is. And here it is. Now I have a clean and quiet place where I can do my homework. So in the morning, when the sun comes up, I like to sit on the back steps and read. And it has this little front yard with the trees. I worry, I do. I worry a lot. I worry for my mom because she puts herself out there. And I worry for my little sister. She's only 5. She's a kid. She doesn't really understand what's going on. And I know she's already falling in love with having a place to call home.
That was Destiny Johnson in a video produced by ZwineWorks. Juan?
Yeah, I wanted to ask Carol Fife about Wedgwood Properties. What can you tell us about the firm itself and also about the public relations guy by the name of Sam Singer that they've selected basically to be their spokesperson on the issue of what's going on in Oakland?
I will speak about that because I have to. I hate to give credence and time to such awful individuals and such evil organizations. Wedgwood Properties has approximately 96 subsidiaries, and they are the real estate speculator that is holding the deed for Mom's House. They are in the business of buying homes at rock bottom prices and flipping them. And that is part of the problem why housing is so unaffordable in cities like Oakland. They buy houses by bulk, so 100 to 200 properties per month, if not more, and distressed neighborhoods, their words, and then they flip them and sell them to the highest bidder. So it puts home prices out of reach for many working class people. So they drive up the cost of rents and the cost of actually purchasing a home, which is why home ownership levels are so low. And since they are such bad characters, they've also hired another bad character to get them out of the situation and make them look like the victim. And that is Sam Singer. And he's doing everything in his power to villainize and criminalize the mothers. And we're seeing old stereotypes and old tropes about black women on every single social media site where the moms are. There's trolls every day that are really working to tear the mothers down. They've experienced different levels of violence, one mother in particular, and it's really sad the levels that they're going to criminalize these moms.
Carol, in Mother Jones magazine, they write, in Oakland, where buyers routinely offer hundreds of thousands of dollars over asking prices, there are nearly 4 vacant properties for every homeless person. It's not so much an issue of scarcity, but of distribution. Explain that further. And then explain what the judge ruled and where you see this headed now. I mean, the images of last night of the hundreds of people who called when some kind of group text went out within minutes coming to the house. But talk about that, the level of vacancy.
And that's what's criminal about this housing crisis. There are actually places where people can live, but because they're private, they're privately owned, it makes it difficult to even crack into what a solution could be, because the private industry doesn't have to be held accountable. And that is what we're saying is criminal. It should not be legal for anyone that owns property, particularly corporations. And we want to make a distinction, because that's what's being thrown around a lot, too, is that if an individual mom and pop owner of a property left it empty because they're on vacation, then somehow Moms for Housing is advocating taking people's personal property. That is completely and patently false. What we're saying is corporations should not be able to hold vacant properties when there is a housing crisis. There should not be people living on the streets when there are places where they can live. This is Oakland looks like an entirely different city than it did years ago. And it's strictly due to corporations that are able to rent gouge when they have homes for rent and charge way over market for homes that are not worth what they're actually selling them for. And so this is starting a movement where people who are also experiencing housing insecurity, which means they pay more than 30% of their income in rent, are waking up because they've seen this example of Moms for Housing defying what the market trends are and saying we deserve housing for all, not just for those who can pay the high price tags.
And Carol, what's been the response of the local political leadership in Oakland? After all, Oakland is famous as the birthplace of the Black Panther Party. It was the place where Jerry Brown was mayor for a while. How have the political leaders responded to this crisis and to the protests in particular of Moms for Housing?
It's actually been mixed, right? We have city council members who've actually been at press conferences standing with the moms. And we are very grateful for their support and their leadership in thinking of creative ways that they can impact the housing crisis. But we also have city council members who have been silent. And you mentioned the Black Panthers, and unfortunately is our African-American leadership that's been silent on this issue. We have had support from other community organizations like the local NAACP. And at the press conference that was recently held in Oakland regarding a Senate bill that's supposed to develop additional housing, we heard on the podium that day, hadn't heard before, that several assembly members and several senators also support Moms for Housing. But what we're asking them, including our congresswoman, our governor, is to do more than just say that you support Moms for Housing. Make that tangible. Create some kind of answer a phone call, answer an email, and really show up. So there's like a tangible way to show that you are concerned about the housing crisis, not just words.
And Dominique, can you talk about what it means to you when you looked outside last night and you saw how many hundreds of people and what this home means to you and your children, what it has felt like being in this house that was vacant for 2 years now for the last 2 months being there?
Yes, last night was amazing. It just showed me that it's still Oakland. We're still Oakland. We are a town of resistance, and we fight back. And we saw our community have our full backs last night. Within 15 minutes, there were over, I think, 300 people mobilized in 15 minutes. That's people power. It's just been amazing to have a shelter for my children and to be this example for them. People always ask me, there's children involved, and I want my children to know that their mother was on the right side of history.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Very quickly, Carol, what's the timeline now? Could Moms for Housing be evicted at any point?
Moms for Housing could be evicted at any point. And I just think it's important to say that we need to take speculation out of real estate, and we need to decommodify housing. And everyone that's showing up over the next 2 days up until Wednesday believes that too. And
Carol, we just hear that there was a text that says the sheriff is knocking on the door and saying people have to clear out. Is that your understanding as we're speaking?
Yeah, gotta go.
Okay. Yeah, I think we got to go.
But we'll continue to cover this. Go to democracynow.org. We'll bring you updates throughout the day. I want to thank Carol Fife of the Oakland Office for Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, and also Dominique Walker, who's one of the moms with her kids in the house. The sheriff is knocking on right now. She's with Moms for Housing. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we hear from Martina Spada. Stay with us. Singing, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, one of the chants from yesterday's protest in Oakland. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Last week marked the one-year anniversary of the passing of Luis Garden Acosta, the founder and longtime president of the nationally known El Puente Youth and Community Leadership Program in Brooklyn. Long regarded as one of New York City's foremost human rights and Latino community activists, Garden died last January at the age of 72. A former seminarian who'd been active in the Catholic anti-war movement, Garden joined the Young Lords Party in 1970 and later founded the group's Massachusetts chapter while he was still a student at Harvard Medical School.
Luis Garden Acosta went on to pioneer successful nonviolent direct action campaigns against segregated public schools and against environmental racism here in New York City. In his later years, together with his wife, Frances Lucena, Garden Acosta created an alternative public high school geared toward human rights activism, the El Puente Academy for Peace and Justice. Well, to honor his legacy, we're joined now by the renowned poet Martina Spada. He is a professor of English at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, author of more than 20 books. His latest collection of poems is called Vivas to Those Who Have Failed. You wrote a poem, Martin, dedicated to Luis Garden Acosta. I was wondering if you could talk about him and share your poem with us.
Yes, of course. Thank you. Luis Garden Acosta was an organizational genius. He was a visionary. He was also a beloved friend and mentor. I wrote this poem based on an encounter that I had with Luis at the beginning of El Puente. It's called Morir Soñando, which means to die dreaming. Morir Soñando for Luis Garden Acosta, 1945 to 2019, Brooklyn, New York. I saw the empty cross atop the empty church on South 4th Street as if Jesus flapped his arms and flew away, spooked by one ambulance siren too many. I saw the stained glass windows I wanted to break with a brick, the mural of St. Mary and the angels hovering innocent as spies over the congregation. I wanted to know why you brought me here, the son of a man punched in the face by a priest for questioning the Trinity, who punched him back. This is El Puente, you said, the bridge. I knew about the Williamsburg Bridge, 8 lanes of traffic, and the subway stampeding in the open windows of the barrio all summer. You spread your arms in that abandoned church and saw the spinning of a carousel better than any wooden horses pumping up and down at Coney Island. Here, the ESL classes for the neighbors cursed with swollen tongues in English. There, the clinics on contraception, the pestilence in the veins of the unsuspecting. Here, the karate lessons, feet spearing the air to keep schoolyard demons away. There, the dancers in white swirling their skirts to the drumming of a bomba. Here, the workshops on Puerto Rican history, La Masacre de Ponce, where your mother's beloved painted his last words on the street with a fingertip of blood. I was a law student, first year, memorizing law school Latin, listening to classical guitar on my boombox as I studied the rules of property. It's mine. It's not yours. I saw only what could be proven by a preponderance of the evidence. The church abandoned by the church, the cross atop the church abandoned by the Son of God. My belly empty as Saint Mary of the Angels. I told you I was hungry. And we left. I wanted Chinese food. But you told me about the Chinese takeout down the block where you stood behind a man who shrieked about the price of wonton soup, left and returned with a can of gasoline, splashed it on the floor, and pulled a box of kitchen matches from his pocket. Will you wait till I pick up my egg roll and pork fried rice? You said, with a high school teacher's exasperated authority. So he did. You could talk an arsonist into postponing his inferno till you left with lunch, but you couldn't raise the dead in the ER at Greenpoint Hospital, even in your suit and tie. You couldn't convince the girl called Sugar to rise from the gurney after the gunshot drained the blood from her body. You couldn't persuade the doctor who peeled his gloves and shook his head to bring her back to life, telling him, "Do it again." An arsonist in medical scrubs trying to strike a wet match. You couldn't jump-start the calliope in her heart so the carousel of horses would rise and fall and rise again. Whenever you saw the gutted church, you would see the sheets of the gurney dipped in red, all the gurneys rolling into the ER with a sacrifice of adolescence. We walked to the luncheonette on Havemeyer Street. A red awning announced, "Morir soñando." "To die dreaming," you said, "from the DR, my father's island." The boy at the counter who spoke no English, brown as my father, called Martin like me, grinned the way you grinned del puente once, Saint Mary of the Angels. He squeezed the oranges into a drizzle of juice with evaporated milk, cane, sugar, and ice, shook the elixir and poured it till the froth spilled over the lip of the glass. Foam freckled my snout as I raised my hand for another. Intoxicated by Morir Soñando number 3 and the prophet gently rocking at my table, I had a vision. ESL classes healing the jaws wired shut by English, clinics full of adolescents studying the secrets of the body unspeakable in the kitchen or the confessional, karate students landing bare feet on the mat with a thump and grunt in unison. Bomba dancers twirling to a song in praise of Yoruba gods abolished by the priests. The words of Puerto Rican rebels painted on the walls by brushes dipped in every color, pressed in the pages of notebooks by a generation condemned to amnesia. Morir soñando. Luis, I know you died dreaming of South 4th Street, the banners that said no for the toxic waste plant down the block, or the Navy bombarding an island of fishermen for target practice thousands of miles away. Morir soñando. I know you died dreaming of a gigantes carnival mascaras bristling with horns that dangled with the angels at El Puente. Morir soñando. I know you died dreaming of the next El Puente. Morir soñando. I know you died dreaming of the hammer's claw, the drill whining to the screw, the dust like snow in a globe, then the shy genius raising her hand in the back of the room. Morir soñando. I know you died dreaming of the poets who stank of weed in the parking lot and stood before the mic you electrified for them and rubbed their eyes when the faces in their poems crowded there waiting for the first word so we could all die dreaming, morir soñando, intoxicated by the elixir of the tongue, oh, rocking prophet at my table.
Mantenga Espada, award-winning poet and professor of English at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Tell us in your own words your how you came to know Luis Gardner. I know he was not only your friend, but was a friend of your father, the late Frank Espada, the great photographer.
And Juan, a dear friend of yours as well.
Yes.
Yes, my father, Frank Espada, was indeed not only a documentary photographer, the creator of the Puerto Rican Diaspora Documentary Project, he was a community activist. He was the founder of something called East New York Action on Blake Avenue in East New York. He worked for the Lindsay administration for a while. And Luis was a political protege of my father. We lived in the Linden Projects of East New York, and I woke up one morning, and I must have been 7 or 8 years old, so this is, say, 1965, and I found Luis sprawled on the couch asleep. I woke him up, and to keep me quiet so I didn't wake up the rest of the household, he had me bring him a book. It was Macbeth. Apparently, he played Macbeth at school. He opened it up. He read these passages, and I was enthralled. He then asked me to memorize the same passage that he read. And then he was astonished when, a few weeks later, he came back, and it turned out that I had indeed had memorized it. He was a personal inspiration for me over the years. When I was 20 years old, he handed me an anthology called Latin American Revolutionary Poetry, edited by Roberto Marquez. And he said, "You will be a poet." And here I am.
Martin, we want you to be able to read one more poem. Introduce Floaters to us, please, and then just take it away.
Sure. Most of your viewers and listeners will be familiar with the photograph that went viral of Oscar and Valeria, two Salvadoran migrants, father and daughter, who drowned in Rio Grande. You may not be familiar with the I'm 1015 Border Patrol Facebook group, where there was some trutherism going on regarding that photograph. And so I wrote a poem in response. It's called, indeed, Floaters. That's the term the Border Patrol uses to describe those who have drowned crossing over. Floaters. Epigraph. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and ask. Have y'all ever seen floaters this clean? I'm not trying to be an ass, but I have never seen floaters like this. Could this be another edited photo? We've all seen the Dems and liberal parties do some pretty sick things. Anonymous post. I'm 1015 Border Patrol Facebook group. Like a beer bottle thrown into the river by a boy too drunk to cry. Like the shard of a styrofoam cup drained of coffee brown as the river. Like the plank of a fishing boat broken in half by the river, the dead float. And the dead have a name. Floaters, say the men of the Border Patrol, keeping watch all night by the river. Hearts pumping coffee as they say the word floaters, soft as a bubble, hard as a shoe, as it nudges the body to see if it breathes, to see if it moans, to see if it sits up and speaks. And the dead have names. A feast day parade of names, names that dress all in red, names that twirl skirts, names that blow whistles, names that shake rattles, names that sing in praise of the saints, Say Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez. Say Angie Valeria Martinez Avalos. See how they rise off the tongue, the calling of bird to bird somewhere in the trees above our heads, trilling in the dark heart of the leaves. Say what we know of them now they are dead. Oscar slapped dough for pizza with oven-blistered fingers. Daughter Valeria sang, banging a toy guitar. He slipped free of the apron he wore in the blast of the oven, sold the motorcycle he would kick till it sputtered to life, counted off pesos for the journey across the river, and the last of his 25 years, and the last of her 23 months. There is another name that beats its wings in the heart of the trees. Say, Tania Vanessa Avalos, Oscar's wife and Valeria's mother, the witness stumbling along the river. Now their names rise off her tongue. Say, Oscar y Valeria. He swam from Matamoros across to Brownsville. The girl slung around his neck, stood her in the weeds on the Texas side of the river, swore to return with her mother in hand, turning his back as fathers do, who later say, I turned around and she was gone. In the time it takes for a bird to hop from branch to branch, Valeria jumped in the river after her father. Maybe he called out her name as he swept her up from the river. Maybe the river drowned out his voice as the water swept them away. Tania called out the names of the saints, but the saints drowsed in the stupor of birds in the dark, their cages covered with blankets. The men on patrol would never hear their pleas for asylum, watching for floaters, hearts pumping coffee all night on the Texas side of the river. No one, they say, had ever seen floaters so clean. Oscar's black shirt yanked up to the armpits, Valeria's arm slung around her father's neck, even after the light left her eyes, both face down in the weeds, back on the Mexican side of the river. Another edited photo. See how her head disappears in his shirt, the waterlogged diaper bunched in her pants, the blue of the blue cans. The radio warned us about the crisis actors we see at one school shooting after another. The man called Oscar will breathe, sit up, speak, tug the black shirt over his head, shower off the mud, and shake hands with the photographer. Yet, the floaters did not float down the Rio Grande like Olympians showing off the backstroke, nor did their souls float up to Dallas, land of rumored jobs and a president shot in the head as he waved from his motorcade. No bubbles rose from their breath in the mud, light as the iridescent circles of soap that would fascinate a two-year-old. And the dead still have names, names that sing in praise of the saints, names that flower and blossoms of white, a cortege of names dressed all in black, trailing the coffins to the cemetery. Carve their names in headlines and gravestones they would never know in the kitchens of this cacophonous world. Enter their names in the book of names. Say Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez. Say Angie Valeria Martinez Avalos. Bury them in a corner of the cemetery named for the sainted Archbishop of the Poor, shot in the heart saying mass, bullets bought by the taxes I paid when I worked as a bouncer and fractured my hand 40 years ago, and bumper stickers read, El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam. When the last bubble of breath escapes the body, may the men who speak of floaters, who have never seen floaters this clean, float through the clouds to the heavens, where they paddle the air as they wait for the saint who flips through the keys in his ring like a drowsy janitor till he fingers the key that turns the lock and shuts the gate on their babble-tongued faces, and they plunge back to earth, a shower of hailstones pelting
them. Thank you so much.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
We must continue to delve deeper into the philosophy of nonviolent resistance.
Hear Martin Luther King Jr.'s Path to Nonviolence, featuring excerpts from his talks and conversation with Dr. Dorothy Cotton of Dr. King's staff and King's eldest daughter, Yolanda King.
But when he was not about business, he was a bit of a cut-up. He was a jokester.
That's Martin Luther King Jr.'s Path to Nonviolence. Air